will indulge me today, this is still the Ask the Pastor series, and one of the questions that was asked was this. I wrote it down. One of the questions that was asked was this: do you think that there has been an overemphasis on the youth in the modern church? Now, you can see on the screen, this conference that I was at this last week, I gave this presentation. This was a workshop that I gave, and it really does fit. It ties in with that question. So you'll indulge me in just basically giving you the workshop that I gave this week. I also did this at another conference back in January. But it's just entitled The Juvenilization of Evangelical Worship. But we can apply this in other areas as well. Make sure this is going. The real impetus for this study, this workshop, were two books. The one on the left is called The Juvenilization of American Christianity, written by Thomas Bergler in 2012. And then he wrote a sequel to that, or a follow-up with that, 2 years later, called From Here to Maturity, Overcoming the Juvenilization of American Christianity. I read the left one first, as is the first one. Very interesting, very thought-provoking. I thought very helpful from a historical perspective on some things that have been going on in the evangelical church in the last 100-ish years or so. And so this is really, what I'm going to do is I'll give several quotes from him, tie in thoughts, and I tend to agree with a lot of things that he's saying here, but I just want to kind of play off some of his big ideas and apply them to the situation and even to the question that was asked. So the first book, The Juvenilization of American Christianity, this is what he describes when he means juvenilization. That it is the process by which the religious beliefs, practices, and developmental characteristics of adolescence become accepted as appropriate for Christians of all ages. He continues on and says, it begins with the praiseworthy goal of adapting the faith to appeal to the young, but it sometimes ends badly with both youth and adults embracing immature versions of the faith. And that's kind of what he's going to go on and argue, really, in the book. That as this has happened, you know, praiseworthy goal, we want to reach the youth, but not really producing what the goal essentially was, really, when both youth and adults become more immature. Okay, so that's what he means, the juvenilization of the church. And the book basically describes how that motivation, that driving goal of appealing to the youth or reaching the youth, has driven modern evangelicalism since about the 1940s. And it has produced, again, what he describes as really less than ideal results. So in historical background, World War II, right, the 1940s, early 1940s, World War II, that was a very changing time. One of those changes took place in society. It used to be, prior to World War II, it was common for young people to end their education at about the eighth grade. My grandfather was one of them. My grandpa used to say he always had an eighth grade education. I never knew why. And now it makes sense. He ended schooling at eighth grade and went into the workforce. That was pretty common. Pretty typical pre that, but really the World War II era and coming out of World War II really changed that, because many of those young people now attended high schools. It wasn't that high school didn't exist, it just was that wasn't really a prominent thing, but it became more prominent around World War II. And as those young people began to go to high school more frequently and more of them went, it created really a new kind of demographic. These youth, these teenagers. In fact, the word teenager didn't come around until 1941. So Diana West, in her book, The Death of the Grown-Up, says, once there was a world without teenagers. That's how she starts the book. I think it's the first line. Talk about a attention grabber. Literally, teenager, the word itself, doesn't pop into the lexicon much before 1941. It really began in this edition of Popular Science in April of 1941, this idea of teenager. Even in the magazine 17, didn't come around till 1944. Teenagers were no longer really viewed as primarily contributors to society, like what they were prior to. They were now more primarily thought of as consumers, as this teenage demographic that we need to appeal to. And we're going to, 17 magazine that's going to appeal to this age demographic. The 1950s and 60s spawned things like the sexual revolution, the rock and roll era. Of course, you have Vietnam and all that went on, spilled out in the 70s and beyond as well. Bergler's contention, my contention today, is that what we are experiencing in the vast majority of American evangelicalism in general, and even worship specifically, including much of our own circles, is the fruit of the seeds that were sown in the American evangelical culture of the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. In other words, where we are today, the state of the American church, American Christianity today, I think what we're seeing is largely the fruit of seeds that were sown 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And while there's some helpful things, of course, but I don't think it is all as rosy as we would like to think. So today, 80 years later, we're seeing an American church, along with its liturgical practices, largely being emotionally immature, theologically immature, and even biblically illiterate. So let me start with some biblical principles about this role, this dynamic between youth and older, the young and the old. What does the Bible have to say about that relationship, that kind of dynamic? So 2 Chronicles 10, the story of Rehoboam taking the throne after Solomon takes the throne. And Rehoboam is approached by Jeroboam about lifting the pressure. And Rehoboam takes a few days and he talks with various counselors. He first talks with the counselors of his father, the aged men. And he talks to the counselors of his own youth, his own peers. And the scriptures say he forsook the wisdom of the elders and took the counsel of his own peers. And of course, the end result was a split kingdom. Psalm 78, 1-8 talks about how older generations need to teach the younger about God. Psalm 145, 4, one generation shall praise thy works to another. Same kind of dynamic there. You have Solomon's words in Proverbs. How many times does he say, my son, this is the wise elderly Solomon seeking to train and teach and impart wisdom to the younger generation. You have Ephesians 6, 1 and 2, where children are to honor and obey their parents. You have this dynamic in the pastoral epistles in Titus 2, where the older to younger, this mentorship or discipleship relationship, right? We have the older men and the younger men. We have the older women and the younger women. This, call it what you want, mentorship, discipleship, whatever you want to call it. But you have this dynamic where the older or to teach the younger. Okay? That makes sense so far? Any questions you have, feel free to just pop your hand up or speak out, whatever. Okay, but this is a biblical principles that we have here, this general idea. It doesn't mean that the older can't learn from younger. Of course, that's possible. That's true as well. But generally speaking, what God puts as the what I think is the overwhelming dynamic of relationship is that the older are to instruct the younger. They're to lead the younger. They're to instruct the younger. They're to shepherd the younger. For instance, in the home, parents are never told to obey their children. Parents are never told to, you need to obey your children. They know what's best. No, it's always the other way around. It's always the other way around. But when parents fail in that and they fall prey to child-centeredness, and do all they can to merely please their children and don't take the authoritative leadership, there's great problems in that home. And that principle does tend to bleed out even into church life. So let me share with you some of Bergler's thoughts, the author of that book. It was probably in the 60s that adolescent versions of Christianity began to make serious inroads among adult Christians. Adolescent spirituality favors physical activity, touch, other bodily ways of expressing faith. He goes on later, describes this, these phrases have a personal relationship with God and falling in love with Jesus. These kinds of emotional, these feely kind of sentiments. Older cultural conceptions of adulthood encourage responsibility and self-denial and service to others. So he's really using this statement to really contrast the juvenilization aspect where youth are this way, but the older conceptions of adulthood and maturity, there's responsibility, there's self-denial, there's service to others. This difference between the adolescents and the adults really began, at least in earnest, in the 40s with the dawn of the youth movement. The youth of the day were viewed as the most important group, and the ideas, and he describes this in his book, the idea was we've got to reach the youth because they are the hope of the world. They're going to change the world, they're going to change society, they're going to change the church, you know, leaders and all those kind of things. We've got to reach them. They're going to change the world. That idea. So we have these different groups that were begun starting in the 40s. For instance, Youth for Christ began in the 40s. We have Young Life, another popular group today, began in the 40s. Campus Crusade for Christ began in the 50s. That's now called CREW, but they began in 1951 with Bill Bright. And they were, specifically, this group, Campus Crusade, was a big player, sponsor of this event called Expo 72, which took place in Dallas. I was born in 73, so I was not around for that, but does anybody remember this? Okay, Deb does. A few of you remember this. Okay, this is a big deal. In Dallas Tech, thousands, tens of thousands of people attended this. It was dubbed as the Christian Woodstock of the day. And the focus of these organizations was essentially reaching the young people, high school and college age, using whatever means they could. So Bergler goes on, Youth for Christ leaders insisted that, quote, youth needed to be reached by any means necessary. Indeed, the music at Youth for Christ, YFC meetings, was close enough to the crooner, girl trio, and big band styles of the day to arouse the ire of some fundamentalists and the scorn of mainline Protestants, but teenagers loved it. And he quotes Jim Rayburn, who was the founder of Young Life, as saying this, it's a sin to bore a kid. That may, I don't remember seeing that in the scriptures. But he was speaking in the context of religious gatherings for these teenagers. So as these groups got started and more teenagers got involved, there were concerns. So he mentions one, 1948, then president of Youth for Christ named Bob Cook. He observed this, quote, a troubling possibility. Instead of saving the world and stamping out juvenile delinquency, right, that's what they were hoping for, that's what they were striving for. Instead of that, Youth for Christ rallies might be nothing more than entertainment for Christian teenagers. That was an interesting statement, an interesting observation that he made, even back in 1948. Bergler goes on and he gives his own commentary on this. So YFC leaders did not worry about the potential corruptions of catering to teenage tastes because they thought they saw a world-transforming youth revival on the horizon. Since the fate of the world depended on winning as many youthful converts as quickly as possible, preachers at Youth for Christ rallies didn't worry about ways they might be subtly altering the gospel message. But in such an atmosphere, it was unlikely that anyone would pay much attention to how youth and their preferences could and would dramatically reshape the face of American Christianity. He goes on later on, evangelicals successfully attracted and retained young people because they aggressively marketed their version of Christian faith using the styles of the 60s youth counterculture. The 60s revealed that the evangelical model of youth work was extremely adaptive to changes in youth culture. As a result, it would become the dominant model across the spectrum of American churches in the decades to come. But the price was indeed high at times, as evangelical youth environments increasingly glorified entertainment and self-fulfillment and downplayed calls to spiritual maturity. When YFC leaders discussed the merits of aggressive use of adolescent musical styles, they recognized that they were potentially changing how people experienced the faith. But in the end, they decided the powerful appeal to youth justify the potential costs. And then Bergler draws a conclusion that as a result of the Jesus people, anybody remember the Jesus people movement? Okay. I never knew they existed until fairly recently, and I've been reading more about them and all the background and everything. It's a fascinating study. Joan, did you want to say something? Or did you just read just saying you remembered it? Yeah.
And my husband and I were invited to dinner by the Jesus people.
Yeah.
And they witnessed to us and we went away laughing. And I can remember one guy sitting there, he was withdrawing from drugs or whatever it was, heroin. And you know, being prayed over and saying, "You can do it because Jesus is there." And I'm thinking, yeah, but he probably needed other things.
Big thing, yeah. Big thing. So he says of them, the Jesus people and the Jesus music of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, they knew this would infiltrate the worship of the church. And he says they gave little thought to ways that worship might become more and more like a dance or a rock concert. So, of course, Bergler's writing this 2012, okay? So he's writing in hindsight, giving his observations about things that he studied and researched as well. It's really difficult to tell what the leaders were actually thinking when they were going through those times, but he does cite at least one, that guy named Bob Cook from 1948. If there were any other concerns that were voiced, it seems like those were pretty quickly dismissed. But if a church adopts a primary motivation to, quote, reach the young people at virtually any cost, pragmatism will reign. And like he hinted at earlier, the end will justify the means. That's pragmatism. And he's concerned about that. Our desire is not pragmatism, but we want to do all things for the glory of God and in a way that will bring glory to God. Okay, thoughts? Anything here? Yes, sir?
Yeah, I remember one of the Jesus movement was anything went, meaning what? Meaning the sexual revolution was integrated right into their way of lifestyle, drugs, everything. And I used to meet them all over the place, you know? And they had this thing, the love thing.
Right.
The big, you know, thing.
Yep.
Love. And teenagers were attracted to this thing. They had this false front that they put on. Some of them were sincere, but they were caught right in the thicket of what was going on, and they really thought they were Christians. Yet anything went, and that's what I remember.
Yeah, the drug culture—that was certainly a big part of it. The sexual revolution, yeah, I think they really came out of that. So the Jesus, if you don't know, the Jesus people movement really came out of hippies being converted. They were converted hippies. And so a lot of those hippie ways, lifestyles, philosophies, and so forth, they just kind of carried over.
They're still doing the same thing.
Yeah. Someone else? No? Yeah, Joan?
I remember walking. One guy said, yeah, Jesus wants to make you high.
Okay.
Where you have a quote about having a personal relationship with
okay.
God, yep. Like one statement from this organization. But I have heard that kind of statement from many conservative
you're right.
preachers. So, I mean,
yep.
why is that a problem? What's the difference?
So what he's raising by mentioning that phrase is that that became the overwhelming dominant idea. It's not that the words themselves are horrible. It's the sentiment that was behind those words. The sentiment of that your Christianity is just, it's you. It's your personal. It's a privatized kind of a thing. Very emotionally driven. That's what he's getting at. I tend to not say that phrase a whole lot. I understand what people mean by that. And I'm not saying you're sinful by saying that. But what he's saying is in that time period, when that became a new thing to say, there was something behind it that they were communicating. Yeah.
Okay, Angela? They were using a lot of updated paraphrase versions that toned the message of the gospel down. Another Jesus, another gospel, another spirit, you know, so that it could fit their criteria of lifestyle, you know.
Yeah.
Angela? Along with what she was saying, I have a lot of friends from CFNI, just an New Age Apostolic Church school. They often say Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship,
right.
It's a personal relationship.
Right.
And it's a way to deny our responsibility in, at any time you want to follow a rule in the Bible, they call it legalism.
Right.
And they always side with, it's a personal relationship. Anytime you say, you try to bring correction, it's a personal relationship, that's legalism, that Christianity is not a religion. And so it's a way, I think it is a juvenilization where it's they want to focus on themselves and not the responsibility
yeah.
of Christianity.
That's a good point. So why is it that, because I hear it a lot too, why would we say Christianity is not a religion, it's a relationship? Do you agree or disagree with that and why?
I disagree because the Bible talks about pure religion, undefiled, and so forth. I mean, you know, you can do anything with religion. You get the bad side, you got the good side. But you've got God's side there, which is the good side that we follow.
Yeah.
That's our religion, and that's our relationship with Christ.
Yeah. Yeah, James 1:27, pure religion, undefiled before God the Father is this. Okay, Deb?
But I think often religion is seen as more of man created, out of the list that you do, the things that you know, I do all this and this and this, and I don't do this and this and this, and it's not about allowing God to direct you.
But I think you're right in that as people perceive what religion is, especially today, oh, that's just your thing. That's just a man-made thing. And I get that, but Christianity is a religion. It's the only true religion.
Amen.
There are scads of false religions that are man-made, and unfortunately, then they tend to get the most airtime, and they tend to cloud what true religion really ought to be. I say it's both. Yeah, Michelle? Right.
When we're witnessing to our unsaved family who have a completely Roman Catholic Church background, that is an organized religion. And
yep.
That's what they think when they say,
right.
You have your religion.
Yeah.
Well, no, my church isn't my religion. My church is where I worship God. So that's where it's
yep.
a really hard line to make to say, well, no, it's not a personal relationship with Christ. It's your the religious practice that you have.
Yeah, yeah, good. Ian?
All right, bear with me. Let me throw this out there.
All right.
Is it really the juvenilization, or is it us being irresponsible in promoting earlier adulthood? So as I look back through history, You know, you can grasp something more recent. Bar, the concept of bar and bat mitzvahs, right, for the Jewish people, which stems back to really Old Testament philosophies of when people reach maturity. And now, more recently, you know, with the sexual revelation, what are we trying to do? You know, we're trying to, let me back up. Years ago, you were allowed to marry when you were 13 or 14. And that was not unexpected in many religions, including earlier Christianity. Mm-hmm. And in the more, let's say in the New England states, and what you can see over the last maybe 60 or 70 years, we as a culture have tried to push adulthood out in a number of ways. You know, high school education, college education, you have to do that.
Push it out meaning prolong it?
Prolong it, okay. Yes. And if you look across America, I think there's a direct relationship between basically juvenilization and in the states that have promoted older marriage laws and funded higher education. Most recently in New Hampshire, for example, we just, and this might shock people, we just made it so 13-year-olds can't marry. Has it happened recently? It hasn't, but I'll tell you what, it was a very well socialist groomed young lady that put that into our law books in New Hampshire. So there seems to be a correlation between trying to push out all the aspects of maturity. And I have three daughters, everyone should know that.
And now they have to wait to get married.
Well, I look and say, should my daughter have gotten married when she was 13 or 14? Today, no, but that wasn't unusual a while ago.
Yeah, just look at your wife. Look at your wife when you say that, yeah.
But it wasn't unusual, and it's maybe a part of it where we are saying, well, we have to prolong, instead of saying, you know what, God designed, you know, our children to become adults as soon as appropriate, have we pushed that out because we want them to be younger longer? Or you know, what is the more biblical model? But every time I look around, I say, yep, no, you can't get married until you are X age, X education, X whatever, instead of looking at even how the you know, Puritans were. You know, anyone who came over here for religious freedom and moral uprightness, they didn't wait until they were 30 to get married. You know?
I don't know that he would disagree with you necessarily. I don't think he would I think what he's trying to do is kind of, where did that all start? And his assertion, you can disagree with that, and that's fine, but I think his assertion is he's highlighting that starting really in the 40s with a lot of these things. And it's probably a combination of a lot of these things.
Yeah, yeah. But I think it's like, okay, you know, we know better. We're going to put these, you know, basically marriage laws on the books. We're going to put these educational requirements on our kids. All of those rules stem from primarily progressive and atheistic supporters.
Maybe.
So we're going to question the one.
I'm not going to say a carte blanche statement like that, but no doubt they probably had a contributing factor in that, yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Going back to what we were talking about with religion and relationship and Christianity,
yeah.
It's gotten to the point where if someone asks you if you're a Christian, you need to first ask them, what do you think that means, before I can answer that question.
Valid point.
Really, because people don't know what it means anymore,
right.
And they don't know, there's so many different, there's an American Jesus, there's Jesus of Scripture, but there's also American Jesus, so if you say you follow Jesus, well, they don't even know what that means either,
right.
So you need clarity before you can have a real discussion with someone.
It's a great point, especially the longer we go,
right?
Because we're living more and more in a Mars Hill culture. Where people know there's an unknown God, but they know nothing about him. So we have to kind of backtrack, like you said, and explain, define, describe. Yeah.
I think we're, maybe I'm misinterpreting, but juvenilization, when we think of juvenilization, I think we're thinking of teenagers rather than children. In my estimation, what I see in a lot of what is going on in mainstream Christianity today, and what Ian says and stuff, is that we are, our the doctrine and everything is pointing to this. Children are very self-focused, extremely self-focused, and everything's about them and their little world. We have to push them out of that into focusing on other people and more mature things. And the doctrines today are very self-focused. So when he's saying juvenilization, maybe it's more of, it's a childish version of it, and our teenagers are being sucked back into that, and instead of being allowed to grow into maturity, we're pulling them back into childhood.
Yeah.
And that's the juvenilization rather than just being teenagers, because, I mean, like Ian said, I mean, for probably millennia, the last 10,000 years since we've been here on Earth, is, well, maybe not, you know, Noah's time, because they lived till like 600 years old. But, you know, maturity was in the teen years. That's when they were able to start families, and that's when they expected to hold jobs and take care of elders and stuff like that. And now we can't even trust them to, you know, make dinner.
Yeah, I don't. Again, I don't disagree with that sentiment. I think it's a yes and. It's all of these kind of things. It is not just pre-teens, it's teenagers, and the juvenilization process is now extending beyond the typical teenage years. And his contention is those sentiments, the immaturity that you see not just in 4, 5, and 6-year-olds, but 14, 15, 16-year-olds now, that's being pushed out and out into grown-ups. That grown-ups are being juvenilized.
Yeah, they're pulled back in the childhood.
Right.
And that's my point about, you know what, when you're 13 and you're out of 8th grade, you know what, you're working and you're getting married.
Right. And that's why he said that changed in the 40s. That's why he starts there. Gary?
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with the comments. I would just say that society in general has also shifted to juvenilization.
Yeah.
A society is much easier to control when people just say, I'm following this leader, I just want, and you get handouts, and you don't have to mature, you don't have to, you know,
be responsible.
And leaders like that, well, some leaders like that, because they're more malleable, people will fall in line.
So this might be helpful to think through as well a little bit. I mean, he starts in the 40s, but really can go back beyond that. There are some pretty significant world stuff that shifted around. For instance, the Renaissance period or the Enlightenment period. Start there. The Enlightenment period sounds all nice, warm, and fuzzy. But the Enlightenment period, otherwise called the what? The Age of Reason. There was a dramatic shift. And what was that shift? Why is it called the Age of Reason? Right. Yeah, it became much more man-centered in thought than God-centered in thought. Prior to that, even though people still denied Christ and didn't follow him, and they're unbelievers, of course, but generally speaking, there was a God awareness. When the Age of Reason came along, those things began to shift. We'll say, and it's a continuum, it takes time. You go beyond that, then we have another big thing called the Industrial Revolution. And the Industrial Revolution, of course, had some really cool stuff. We're thankful for advancements in technology and machinery and all those kind of things. But that also brought on something else, too. It brought on a lot of leisure. Leisure time. As things became more automated, more people had more time on their hands. All of these things are contributors to this whole thing. Okay? He just tends to start at the 40s. He's starting there saying, okay, here's a significant shift within the last 100 years that I think he can quantify, even when the word teenager came around, all those kind of things. I don't disagree with any of you. I think you're hitting on some valid points. I would also say the great conspiracy is less man-made, it's more satanic, ultimately. And if we can keep our minds focused on that, there is a prince of the power of the air, the spirit that now works in children of disobedience, that he does have a plan, he does have a desire. And so we got to keep that in mind as well. Yeah?
Just an eye-middle into their 20s and even into their 30s.
Mm-hmm.
But yet we're hyper-sexualizing, hyper-adulting children. Mm-hmm. The littlest ones, we're trying to force
yep.
them into making sexual and very mature decisions
right.
at such a young age. So we have this older segment that should be mature being juvenilized and
yep.
this younger set being hyper-adultized.
Yeah.
I know that's not a word, but...
We'll call it good today.
Yeah, for it. So it's just this
yeah.
weird dichotomy,
yeah.
and we're putting little minds that are not mature making huge decisions.
Mm-hmm. Almost forced to.
Right, and it's just
yeah.
upside down world.
Yeah, you're right. It's an upside down world. And again, when you take God out of the center,
yeah.
things get topsy-turvy. Yeah.
One of the big things was this music. It was thunderous. It was so loud that I actually didn't feel good sometimes because the music was so loud and rocky, and they were putting up black drapes on the stage, closing up the windows and everything. Got lights on the curtains. They were making it more like a nightclub type atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
And one of the kids heard me talking about how loud it was. And he says, I don't think it's loud. He says, then those of us that are on the music committee, he says, none of us have a problem. So we just got up and left one day.
Yeah.
And I met up with the minister's wife about a month or so later. It was a little awkward. I said, you probably know why I left. I said, it was... music. And she says to me, you know, we're trying to reach the youth because that's the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
And she says, I make no apology.
Mm-hmm. And that stems from this. It really does.
Yes.
It really does stem back to this.
That was just astounding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, good discussion. Yeah. Last comment.
I was going to went to a Christian concert the other night and I wanted to explain.
Would she like to explain? Yeah, yeah. So, okay, last comment. So the CCM world, contemporary Christian music world, that stems way back to the Jesus people. They spawned it. Okay, and other influences too, but they are a big key. The Jesus people movement spawned the contemporary Christian music world. Just, you know, that's why. I think a lot of that goes there. All right, we'll continue this next week. The good discussion. Thank you very much. You're dismissed.